So thank you everybody for your patience. There's been a lot of discussion which was better to take place in chambers as council were reflecting on their respective cases or individual cases, and we didn't want that to populate the minds of witnesses. Mr. Moore is briefly going to address the court about where the regional council has got to.
Thank you, Your Honour, and for the benefit of those that haven't been in the room for the last couple of hours, the regional council will be producing some further supplementary evidence attaching to it a further marked up version of Plan Change 7 that focuses the plan change back onto procedural matters only, as opposed to the procedural matters plus the environmental matters. That will be circulated just as soon as we're able to do so, anticipating this week in terms of that document. So that's what's going to follow, but we're simply going to now proceed with the witness.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps the only other comment to reflect on is the NPS for freshwater management.
Yes. Do you want me to address?
Yes.
So the other, or one other matter that the council's going to be addressing is the relevance of the policies within the new NPS that must be brought down into existing operative and proposed planning instruments.
Cool. And so now we're with Mr. Page and his cross-examination.
Thank you, Mum. Mr. De Pelsmaker, I'm going to start at tab 1, volume 1 of the bundle. I wonder if you have it. I won't do the job today. Tab 1, volume 1. So it's the first one standing up. That one.
We're after the regional plan, are we?
Yes.
Thank you.
And so that's the operative regional plan under tab 1.
Just remember it's not by 6A, that's all.
Yeah, I've got a recent copy actually.
Never mind, we're going to ancient history, so happily this one will do.
Sweet.
Yeah. No, but that's correct. That's the operative plan.
All right, can you have a look at Common Bundle page 4, please? So the Common Bundle page numbers are the top corner.
Yes.
And what you will see is there is a table called Chronicle of Key Events, don't you?
Correct.
And if we go down to the seventh line in that table, you will find Plan Change 1C, Water Allocation and Use, won't we?
Correct.
And Plan Change 1C was made operative on the 1st of March 2012.
That is correct.
All right. Can we now then turn to page Common Bundle 80? That's 80.
What provision?
Sorry?
What provision are you looking for?
We should find policy 6.4.0 capital A. Do you have that?
Yes, I have.
Thank you. And is this the policy that is referred to, I think, in Ms. Dicey's evidence as the one requiring permits to be issued only for an efficient use allocation of water?
I don't have. Can you refer?
All right. Well, look, let's not worry about what Ms. Dicey says about it. Let's have your opinion. Is policy 6.4.0A concerned with allocating no more than is required for the purpose that the water is required?
That is correct.
And it was introduced by Plan Change 1C in March 2012.
I believe so.
Yeah. And do you know that since March 2012, through this policy, the Otago Regional Council has been encouraging water permit holders to adopt efficient water use practices?
Yes.
And that includes and has included investing in water storage through dams and pivot irrigation infrastructure.
Yes.
And do you recall that council engaged an officer to liaise with farmers to encourage them to that end? And the person who was engaged for that purpose was none other than Ms. Susie McKeague.
That is correct.
And since March 2012, do you agree that millions of dollars have been spent by farmers in Otago in efficient irrigation infrastructure under policy 640 capital A, encouraged by the regional council?
Yeah. I find that a reasonable assumption. Yes.
Yeah. Because the regional council's advice to permit holders has been that if they can show that their use of the water is efficient, they are more likely to get it back on a renewal of their permits, right?
In combination with policy 642A, that would be the case, yes.
Yes. And 642A, just for our recollection, is the policy concerned with only getting back the water you can show you've actually used.
In catchments that are fully allocated?
Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And so, not only have farmers been spending millions of dollars on dams and pivots, encouraged by the regional council, they've also been spending millions of dollars on the research necessary for applications for renewal of their permits in anticipation of 1 October 2021, right?
Again, I find it a reasonable assumption.
Yeah. Well, you've been involved in some of those, such as the Lindis case.
Yes.
Yeah. So, do you understand, having spent all that money, how stressful it is for farmers to be told now, under Plan Change 7, that they can only get their permits back for 6 years because the council may not want to reissue them with any water rights in 6 years' time?
Yes.
Well, let's come to the reasons for that then. Do you have paragraph 44 of your own evidence available, your evidence in chief? It's on page 14 of your brief.
Yes.
And here at paragraph 44, you set out the issues that Plan Change 7 is seeking to address, right?
Correct.
And I want to take you through them one by one. The first, under A, is a lack of understanding about the state of the region's freshwater resources and the effect of water takes on those resources. When you are referring to a lack of understanding, do you mean that the regional council lacks an understanding of that issue? It's not the permit holders that don't understand, it's the ORC.
That is correct.
Yeah. So that's a fault, if you like, of the ORC, not of permit holders. You agree?
In terms... Can I...
Yes.
Qualify that. I accept that water users might have a better understanding of quantities of water taken from water bodies. In terms of the effects of water takes, I cannot speak on behalf of water users.
Yes. But your evidence seems to be directed at the need for an interim regime because the council lacks an adequate understanding
that is correct
of the issues.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's come to B then. uncertainty about the environmental outcomes, limits and flows from the NPS. NPS FM 2020.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Now, again, that is not a circumstance brought about by water permit holders, is it? The need to address that issue?
No.
Thirdly, that allocation may not prioritise the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. That's a reference to the first tier of Te Mana o Te Wai, isn't it?
Correct.
So how the allocations have prioritised that issue is a matter for the regional council. It's not something that permit holders have brought about.
Correct.
Coming to D is an easy one, an inadequacy of the current planning framework. That's the regional council's mm-hmm. responsibility, right?
Correct.
And E, the pending expiry of a large number of water permits. Again, it's not permit holders that have orchestrated that circumstance, is it? That's a function
no.
of the law.
Yeah.
So my question to you is that if none of the issues that are arising pertain to anything permit holders have done, why is it that it's permit holders that have to pay for applying for temporary placeholder resource consent applications?
When you say pay, what do you mean? Do you mean the fees for filing an application, or do you mean something else?
I'll break it down into two parts. Firstly, you accept that an application for resource consent, there's a cost in preparing an application that the permit holder bears?
Correct.
And the cost of the regional council processing those resource consents are recovered from the applicants, aren't they?
Correct.
Now, given that Plan Change 7 has been brought about for reasons unconnected with permit holders, why is it that permit holders are being asked to pay for the consent process required to give the ORC breathing space to get its house in order?
In response to that, I think it's important to understand that the plan change itself does not impact on consented uses as they are consented at present. The plan change kicks in when people are going to apply for a new consent. I admit that there's Plan Change 7 creates a degree of uncertainty, but that uncertainty, I believe, is inherent in how the RMA works as well. Consents are not in perpetuity. They expire. Unless an activity is permitted or has a status of a controlled activity, there is no guarantee that consent holders will get a new permit going forward. So I accept that the plan change creates social and economic it has economic impacts and it creates social stress. I do not want to underplay that. But at the same time, what we also try to do by giving the renewal of existing deemed permits and resource consents to take water, we've given them a controlled activity status as well, which I believe gives them in some way security as well, be it for the short term, but it is a layer of certainty that would otherwise not be provided.
Yeah, okay. I want to bring you back to the transaction cost of the process.
Correct.
I accept that for deemed permit holders on the 1st of October 2021, they were always up for a new application, weren't they?
Correct.
But what Plan Change 7 does is now create a two-step process, doesn't it? We've got short-term consents until 2026 or 7 or whatever it might be, I forget. And then there's another application for substantive consents at that point moving forward, haven't we?
That is correct.
So we've got, from the permit holder's point of view, they've gone from a one-step application for renewal to a two-step application for renewal, correct?
Correct.
And they pay for the lot, even though it's not their fault.
That is correct.
Why is that fair?
Again, I do not want to underplay the stress that this causes, but fairness is not something that is dealt with under the RMA. We have tried, through the control activity pathway as well, to reduce the cost of the initial consent, and I acknowledge that under the current circumstances where you have two plans, that might be difficult.
And so can I just get you pause there just to be clear? When you say under two plans,
sorry,
do you mean that because we also require consent under the operative plan at the moment as well as PC7?
Correct.
Yep.
So we've got like a legacy issue, and I acknowledge that, where people have been probably preparing for a consent for a number of months or years. They've invested in that. Then they apply for a consent under proposed plan change 7, but the current operative rules still apply, so it's kind of a complex process. One of the reasons why this plan change has been called in is to speed up the process in which we currently are, so the plan change can become operative more quickly. Once that is resolved, hopefully we can have a framework in place that allows at least the first step or the first consent process, the one for the short duration, to be as cost-effective as possible.
You understand, don't you, that at least the deemed permit applications all need to be in by the end of this month if they're allowed to continue under Section 124?
I do understand that.
And so for those applicants, their activity status is fixed on the date of the application, right?
I do understand that, yeah.
So by the time PC7 becomes operative, the horse is already bolted on whether the controlled activity pathway is available, because their activity status is fixed on the date of application.
I agree with you. I've asked myself that question as well.
Yeah.
What about deemed permits? And then I asked myself the question, well, if you take the deemed permits out of the equation, would there still be a benefit to the plan change? And I believe so, because new permits will be granted. Does it make sense, knowing that you are going to develop a new plan, a new land and water plan, and that needs to be notified by 2023, needs to be operative by 2025, does it make sense in that context to provide for longer-term consents? And the answer that I arrived to myself was probably not. Yeah. So I think there's a wider issue than deemed permits.
Sure. When I read the Minister's recommendation to the Council, it seems to me that the focus of the Minister's concern was the deemed permit renewal process. Is that not your understanding of what the Minister was concerned about?
Could we just bring that document in front of us? I'm not sure whether you've got it. You should have it.
I have it.
That's all right. We'll give it to you. You should have that before answering the question or any document. You know, you should, generally speaking, you should have the documents before answering questions. So we've got the minister's decision. Yeah. The ministerial direction to... which decision are you wanting? The direction to refer to the court or something else?
No, the recommendation under 24A, ma'am.
Okay. Recommendation under 24A. I know it's on the website. It's Appendix D to your evidence in chief. Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay. And let's just have a look at that before you ask the question.
Can I refer the witness to the passage that I had in mind, ma'am?
You can, but I'm just concerned to make sure that the witness knows generally what the content of that document is, so that he's read it and then you can refer to the passage. So just take your time reading it, Mr. Kalfmaker.
Is there a specific passage?
Have you read the document?
I have read the document,
okay,
yes,
good.
Yes.
Thank you. And the passage?
I have read it in preparation for the hearing. I have not read it now.
You should read the document.
Yep.
Yep, that's the time that I'm allowing you.
Thank you.
Perhaps if I break the proposition down into bite-sized chunks, ma'am, the witness might find it easier.
Have you read the correspondence?
I have read the response of Minister Parker.
So you've read the letter of...
I have, yes. That's the letter of...
Okay.
There's no...
It's Appendix
November,
D.
November. I think it, yeah, yep. It doesn't have a date on it, but it's okay. From November 2019.
Yes. Thank you.
Your questions?
Well, for context, this recommendation responds to the report from Professor Skelton, doesn't it?
It does.
And we can see on the second page of the recommendation a heading rollover of deemed permits. On the second
yes,
page?
Yes.
And you will see the Minister records Professor Skelton's advice that the expiry date for deemed permits be extended by legislation.
Yes.
And the Minister goes on to say, I'm not in favour of changing the RMA to extend the date of expiry of the deemed permits. A 30-year transition period was already provided to manage the issue. I prefer that the ORC take steps to resolve the matter rather than taking up the time of Parliament.
Yes.
And then he goes on to describe the urgent need for a planning framework and makes a recommendation on the third page.
Yes.
Halfway down, there's a paragraph numbered 3 because it was the third recommendation. Prepare a plan change by 31 March 2020 that will provide an adequate interim planning and consenting framework to manage fresh water up until the time that the new discharge and allocation limits are set in line with the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management.
Correct.
Right. So do you take from that recommendation that the Minister was primarily concerned with deemed permits but recognised in the following paragraph that there were also others that would be caught up in the process?
The Minister refers to between 400 and 600 future consent applications. If we look at the report that we provided to the court a couple of days ago, the total sum of the deemed permits and also the ones that are not deemed permit that will be renewed or need to be renewed prior to 2025 brings us up to a total of about 500. So I assume that that is part of the context.
Yes.
It is a wider context than just deemed permits.
Yes, the recommendation captures those other permits.
Yes.
But it arises from the Minister not accepting Professor Skelton's recommendation about the deemed permit rollover date.
Correct, yeah.
Now, if we're looking for a way to hold the line, I think you were, expressed it in answers to questions yesterday, in a way that doesn't cost permit holders any money, wouldn't a permitted activity rule that contains parameters concerning historic use of water be a cost-effective way of providing that interim framework until the LWRP gets notified?
It would be a cost-effective way for current consent holders. But in my evidence in reply, I stated some concerns about that approach, and I can probably refer to paragraphs. That's in paragraph 82 of my evidence in reply.
Okay. So let's take those from paragraph 82 of your reply. You say that the paragraph A
the costs associated with the use of this resource for private gain would fall on the wider public. What costs are you talking about?
I am not referring to monitoring costs. My understanding is that above 5 litres per second, we still have to monitor. But I need to read the regulations again to make sure that I'm on the right track there. But in general, with permitted activity conditions, there is no obligation on consent holders to monitor.
And so you're saying that's something that counts against the permitted activity rule?
It is usually council that would probably need to monitor the effects of those activities on water bodies.
Right. Is the monitoring that you have in mind that permit holders should do addressed by the controlled activity rule?
Controlled activity rule does allow us to put compliance monitoring conditions on those consents. And also, with controlled activities, council usually has a better understanding where those stakes occur. At the moment, we have a number of permitted, and that's one of the issues with the current plan, we have a number of permitted activity rules in the plan related to the taking and use of water. It's, like I said, one of the issues that we're dealing with is also, in terms of our fresh water accounting, getting a better understanding of where those stakes are and what is the volume. So I think those types of issues are quite common for permitted activities.
Okay. But isn't the permitted activity rule, for example, that Ms. Dicey has proposed in her evidence, directed at simply allowing permit holders to carry on as they are under their existing permits? So it's only those people that would have the benefit, that is, existing mm-hmm. permit holders, that would have the benefit of the permitted activity rule, and only to the extent of their existing permit. So you know exactly the location of the take and what they're allowed to take.
That is correct. However, it does raise some issues around the transfer of the locations of point of take when it's a permitted activity. How can we manage that? How can we keep track of that?
But that's already a discretionary activity in your plan, isn't it, transferring points of take?
If it's a consented activity, yes. But if it's a permitted activity, I could not.
Yeah. All right. But that's the question of transferring points of take from that specified under a permit. That's really just a bit of draftsmanship to deal with, isn't it, in terms of framing up a permitted activity rule?
Could be, but it was not within the rule that I considered, or recommended relief that I considered.
All right, then. Let's look at 82B, then. A permitted activity status to be effective in sustainable managing water resource, the standards and terms applied to need to be certain, unambiguous, and relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it possible simply to require the standards and terms of the existing permits to be stated? If all we're effectively doing is rolling the permits over for 6 years?
Correct. However, various permits have various conditions. It would be really hard. For example, there are permits that can that often I refer to take cessation conditions where you have a number of permits within a catchment. They cannot be exercised at the same time. It would be really hard to draft or to make sure that those situations are provided for across the region through a permitted activity rule that applies across the region. Mm.
So are you anticipating, for comparison purposes, that the controlled activity rule will enable that sort of machinery to be inserted into controlled activity permits?
That could definitely be done, yes.
Now, I want to come to F, where you raise the question of a permitted baseline.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand your reasoning in paragraph 82F about what the permitted baseline is that you are concerned about. Can you explain that to me?
It was basically a point that was raised with, by Ms. McIntyre. And when I thought about it, I considered it a valid point. From recollection, the issue that she's pointing at is that if you have a permitted activity, a permitted water take, if the effects are of a certain scale, then other activities that would require consent, but that would have similar activities, would prevent notification of that activity. That is how I interpreted the rule.
I didn't actually quite understand. Can you perhaps rephrase that?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
Because you have a permitted activity or a permitted water take with certain effects, the consequence could be that similar activities that
with
have
similar effects,
with similar effects, but that require consent, that it would preclude notification of those activities when they are applied for.
Well, I'm not sure how we jump to notification, but maybe Ms. McIntyre can address that. But is that how do you understand the baseline under Section 104? What do you you're talking about the baseline. I'm assuming you mean here the baseline under Section 104 of the Act?
Correct.
Yeah. How do you understand that provision?
Can I read Section 104 again?
You can, but before you do, tell me, is this something that you normally do in your job, apply?
No, I'm not. I'm not a consents planner.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. All right. So in this piece of evidence, you're responding to something Ms. McIntyre has said.
And that I thought was plausible or valid.
Okay. Okay. All right. Sorry, Mr. Page. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, you've explored the point, ma'am, so I'm happy to move on. So if the permitted baseline point turned out to be of no concern, can you see that a permitted activity status which would only benefit people who hold existing permits for the duration of Plan Change 7, why that might be a more efficient way of simply saying we're holding the line here, carry on as you were until we've sorted out the land and water regional plan?
In principle, yes, but I think through the conversation, I alluded that there are some intricacies, I believe, to different circumstances in which water is being taken, and it would be really hard to capture that in a permitted activity rule.
Yeah. So your answer to that concern is to put all the permit holders through a consent process at their cost so that you don't have to worry about it. Is that the answer?
Yes.
All right. I was left unclear yesterday in answers to questions whether you regard some of Otago's catchments as being degraded. Do you have a view about that?
I think there's a degree of uncertainty, and that's the issue around degradation or overallocation is in essence the same. You need to have certain limits, and in the case of degradation, target attribute states, I believe, before you can make that that call, that assessment.
So is your point that there may be catchments that are degraded, but in a technical planning sense, you're unsure whether you can use that term as it's defined in the NPS? Is that where we are?
That is correct. The definition of degraded refers to target attribute states. We haven't said those.
Yeah.
It refers to environmental flows and levels, and we haven't said those. So it's an assessment that at the moment we cannot make on in relation to this NPSFM.
The evidence of Ngāi Tahu suggests that, at least from their point of view, there are catchments in Otago that are degraded from the taking of water, isn't it? Isn't it?
That is, yeah.
Yeah. Well, have you had a look at clause 3.20 of the NPS that you will find on Common Bundle, page 686? So that is volume 1, tab 4, mm-hmm. Page Common Bundle 686.
Yes.
Clause 3.21, that's subparagraph 1, I mean. If a regional council detects that an FMU or part of an FMU is degraded or degrading, it must, as soon as practicable, take action to halt or reverse the degradation, for example, by changing a regional plan or preparing an action plan.
You're at clause, sorry?
320, paragraph 320. 1.
Oh, paragraph 1. I was looking at 321, thinking, that's not right, that's the definition.
No, that would be wrong.
Yeah, so paragraph 3. Clause 3.20, subparagraph 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, just be careful because transcription have to record this.
Yes. Mm. So is your position that paragraph 1 of clause 3.20 doesn't apply, or do you think it might?
I guess the key words are as soon as practicable.
Yes.
As soon as practicable, to me, is not the same as immediately. And therefore, in my opinion, it is better to defer that to the land and water plan,
yeah.
Which is not too far away from into the future, and which will be developed in accordance with the regulations in the RMA.
Yeah. But you know, don't you, that a lot of applications for resource consents in the Otago region have already been lodged in with the council?
Correct.
For replacement permits?
Correct.
What I'm asking you is whether clause 320, paragraph 1, might be applicable to the catchments that the permits relate to.
In the absence of NPSFM, in the absence of limits and attribute states that are set under this NPSFM, I cannot make that.
You don't know?
I don't know. It's
okay. Yeah. Well, if you don't know, then just say don't know. That's just the way it is. Do you get the sense, though, from the NPS that the council should be moving to at least start giving effect to tier one of the NP of Te Mana O Te Wai as soon as practicable?
Sorry, I'm just thinking.
I'm not hiring you. You take
no.
whatever time you need.
I think, to be honest, as soon as practicable needs to be interpreted within the wider context of the NPSFM. There are a number of principles within the NPSFM that, pointing at some as the integrated management of resources, Kyoto Kitai as well. And that leads me to believe that the NPSFM seeks councils to undertake action as soon as practicable in a holistic and integrated way.
Do you have objective 2.1, paragraph 1 of the NPS in front of you? Common Bundle, page 673.
Sorry, which objective you on now?
Objective 2.1.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Do you have that?
Yes. In, yep.
And that sets out the objective of the NPS.
Correct.
And it sets out the requirement to prioritise three elements of Te Mana O Te Wai. And the first is the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. Right?
Correct.
That's got nothing to do with human values, does it? That's pure science.
I think I think it might go beyond that. If I'm honest, when you read 10.1, when you read objective 1A, you would read that within the context of the mana to Y, which also includes Māori of water bodies. And I'm not an expert in this field at all, but my understanding is that it goes beyond Western science, if I may say, use that terminology. There's a cultural health aspect related to it as well, or could be, if te mana o te wai is defined in that way. So I would think that it goes beyond purely ecology and hydrology.
The health needs of people are dealt with in the second priority, aren't they?
Correct.
And cultural well-being is the third priority, or at least included in, correct?
Correct.
So if we're talking about the needs of water bodies and freshwater systems themselves, that's a matter of research and scientific expertise to understand what those needs are, isn't it? That's the difference between the first, second, and third priorities.
I think the first priority, when I refer to the cultural health, it was in reference to the cultural health of water bodies. Again, I'm not an expert in this. Whereas the third priority refers to the cultural health or the well-being of communities.
Okay. All right, well, that's your understanding of it.
And I'm not an expert, yeah.
So what I will do is I'll state my next question as a hypothetical, assuming your understanding isn't correct.
Is correct or is not?
Assuming the witness's understanding is not correct.
Not correct.
Uh-huh. Yes. If priority one is a matter of science and the adequacy of the science about the needs of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems, and we have the science available to us to set limits to protect priority one, shouldn't we get on and do that right now?
In response to that, we need to get onto it as quickly as possible. But the risk is that we are doing this through a resource consent process. And there are a number of risks associated with that. First of all, we don't know what the endpoint is going to be, where we need to be at. And I think it came true in some of the evidence provided by ORUG, Mr. Graham, that actually having to go through a step process or an incremental process where you get towards the end point in different stages, that has a cost associated with it as well. The consent process as well is different than a planning process. The PSFM is quite clear, in my view, that it seeks to achieve outcomes through a planning process in consultation with communities and with Tangata Whenua. And then my third consideration would be that you could, to some degree, get there, and there being in terms of making considerable progress, but to do that also on a catchment scale, you need to be in a situation where all the consents come in at the same time, which would allow you to be consistent in your decision making as well. If that's not the case, I think consents would be considered on a case-by-case basis, potentially in absence of the outcomes, with different outcomes as well.
Okay. So let me pose two counterfactuals for you to compare. The first is that under the applications that are before the council now, minimum and residual flows might be imposed, because that's what they promote. Secondly, for the next 6 years, under Plan Change 7, there are no limits at all that protect Tier 1 of Te Mana Otawai. Why do you prefer the latter than the former? If we're protecting Tier 1 of Te Mana Otawai.
I don't think that it will... I accept that consents that are granted now will... if we would not set environmental conditions on them, I would accept that the effects of those takes, or the adverse effects of those takes, would continue for the next 6 years. However, Plan Change 7 does not preclude any gains to be made within the next 6 years. The ORC's work program is to have a plan notified by the end of 2023. When it's notified, the provisions can already be taken into account. So from 2024 onwards, progress can be made.
Yeah, but isn't the council's proposition here that they simply want to roll over the existing permits for 6 years? Isn't that what's being advanced against the counterfactual where permit holders are saying, no, we're ready to go and we're happy to impose limits?
Correct.
That's kind of bizarre, isn't it? That the permit holders should be advocating for limits to protect Tier 1 of Te Mana Otawai, and the ORC are saying, no, do nothing for 6 years.
I guess that the situation that you described there applies to a number of catchments in central Otago. The first one that comes to mind is Manaharikia. There's a few other ones, but they're deemed permit-dominated catchments.
Yeah.
And I think it's important.
Arrow and Cadrona would be two
Arrow
other
and Cadrona
examples,
as well. But the plan change goes beyond Manaharikia. It tries to deal with an issue that is wider.
But you know, don't you, that both the permit holders and the council on behalf of the people of Otago have spent millions of dollars in the last 5 years in the Manaharikia on science and modelling to set minimum flows.
Yes.
And Mr. Henderson told us that the hydrology information to do that is there and ready.
That is correct.
So why are we putting it off for 6 years?
Because it is the hydrology is one important piece in a wider puzzle. Other pieces being the outcomes. There are other, in Manaharikia, I admit that the technical information is complete or largely complete, but the approach to one catchment, I don't know if it's quite appropriate to have the situation in one catchment determining how we manage other catchments in the region.
Imagine you are a Central Otago Roundhead Galaxid. You are facing extinction. Do you mind if you face that for another 6 years without any limits that protect you?
It is definitely something that I thought about as well, given the when I was contemplating the evidence of the Department of Conservation, and also given the priority status that's been given to threatened species under the NPSFM. But I also considered the evidence of Dr. Alabone, which says that in some cases, some of those populations might be there because of current practices, and that the risk of extinction within the lifespan of this plan change is very limited.
That's your understanding of his evidence, is it?
I believe that it is in his evidence.
We're approaching 1 o'clock, and you are approaching your hour. So have you got much to go?
Only the non-complying matter, Mum.
How long will that take?
5 or 10 minutes.
Do you want to continue, and then we'll break for lunch? How's that sound?
I think a break for lunch might be useful, Mum.
Oh, you mean right now?
Ah, sorry.
Yeah, do you want to finish your questions, or do you want to break for lunch and think about your non-complying angle?
Well, I think if we break for lunch now, yep, then I'll hopefully be more concise after lunch.
All right, very good. Right, well, we'll break for lunch back here at 2 o'clock.
All rise.